This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
There's a saying that goes, absolute power corrupts absolutely, which means having power corrupts people or lessens their morality. And the more power someone has, the more corrupted they will become. But how true is this? Does absolute power corrupt absolutely? I'm Darshan Johan, and this is Today I Learned. On the show with me today is Assistant Professor Dr. Karim Bhattash, Lecturer in Social Psychology and Global Political Economy at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Welcome back to the show, Karim. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm doing well. Glad to be back on your show, Darshan.
All right. So, I brought that very famous saying, in the introduction, I mentioned it. There's another saying that I really like from my favorite movie of all time, which is Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight. And the saying goes, you either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain. And this is similar to this idea of absolute power corrupting absolutely. What is your take? Does absolute power corrupt absolutely?
Yes, I would say yes. Okay. This seems to be part of human nature. We need restraints to navigate a so-called social world. Human beings have natural needs, such as a need for food, but also a drive to reproduce, which expresses itself in sexual desires. So if unconstrained, a human being would just grab what he wants, take all the food he can get, or mate with every attractive female he can find. You also see it in children, for example. When they are very young, they still have not yet formed, you could say, a mental system that understands other people's feelings. We say the child has not developed yet a theory of mind. Okay, that's what we say in psychology, a theory of mind.
Right.
So the child grabs what it wants, okay, puts anything in its mouth and does not know how to share with other children. However, the child soon starts to realize through pretend play that also other kids have wants, needs, and feelings. And when they are not considering those feelings of other kids, they will continuously have fights with other children. Okay. And he will see other children cry, but also he will feel it when another child takes away his toys, for example. Okay, so then he feels like the stress and the anger and the sadness in him or herself.
Right.
So through pretend play and learning from adults, the child slowly forms a theory of mind, or we could say the understanding that other people have feelings just like themselves. This is very important because we are social human beings. And by controlling our urges, we become very successful social beings. Okay, so human beings are highly group-dependent species. And you can see this by how our cultures, such as religion, are based in controlling our urges. Okay, think, for example, about the Quran or the Bible, and how much of these scriptures is based in controlling your urges. All these norms evolved because it resulted in successful group living to such an extent that over the course of history, the tightest, most communal groups with the strictest social norms were better able to survive than not so tight groups, because supportive groups help one another in need for food, shelter, protection, warfare, and so on. Now, imagine that you do not need group protection anymore. How could this be? You do not need others for food. You do not need others for shelter. You do not need others for protection. Then, of course, you do not need to care about others' feelings and do your best, for example, to successfully become part of a community. Now, you can ask yourself the question, does that exist? Well, yes, in a capitalistic system where we live in, it exists. Think about having so much wealth that you can rely on yourself for food, shelter, and protection, that you are so powerful that you do not need to rely on anyone else. This is the moment that you corrupt as a human being. Psychological studies have shown that the more money you have, the less you care about other people's feelings. In fact, studies have shown that rich people have a much harder time understanding the emotional expressions of other people around them. They have much more of a problem than, for example, poor people. Why is that? Because poor people need to be highly aware of other people's feelings to survive. Okay, you must understand how the people in your family, in your close-knit group, how they are feeling. Otherwise, you may be excluded. And then it would be very hard for a person with not a lot of resources to survive. So people who have absolute power tend to do what they want much more than those who have no power.
Okay, so what you mentioned here is very interesting, right? Because are you then saying that human beings, for the most part, perhaps are inherently selfish, and it's these social norms that we have developed over the years, and this need to rely on one another that have made us more, you know, perhaps less selfish, more empathetic, and things like that, because we know we need one another to move forward. And because in a capitalistic society, you realize that as long as I have the money, I will be fine. So you become more individualistic and that corrupts you. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, very, very good what you're saying there. Indeed. So we are actually human beings. I always say we are naturally collaborative or naturally selfish.
Right.
Depending on the context we live in. So if we naturally grow up in a situation where we need others, we become collaborative. If we naturally grow up in a place where we don't need others, we become individualistic. So why is it that Europe or the United States are very individualist societies, while, for example, East Asia or Southeast Asia are very collectivist societies? Well, if we think about our larger scale systems, our capitalistic system, then you see that the more wealth in a society, the more individualistic people become. So you make a very good point there.
Right. Now, let's talk about, you know, people gaining power in the first place, right? Before the power can corrupt, you need to first have power. Because if you put aside, let's say, you know, conquerors, you know, maybe colonizers and things like that, who basically, you know, go to your land and take your place by force. So putting that aside, in general, let's say if you just want to rise up the ranks in a fairly politically stable country, right? When you're rising up the ranks to gain power, you do need to have a certain level of empathy, right? You need to go on the ground. You need to build grassroots support. You need to give respect. You need to understand the people's struggles more. Sometimes you come from the people themselves, right? You are probably someone who struggled from the ground up. Would you agree that generally that is how you need to get power?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I would say that those who have a good doses of empathy usually don't become very powerful because their concerns for others keeps them in check, okay? Unless they suddenly become super rich, for example, which may transform their natural tendency, empathetic people are usually those who do not want power because they just care about others' feelings too much, okay? So it's very hard to become powerful. It is not a coincidence that the most powerful people in the world, such as Joe Biden, Donald Trump, Jeff Bezos, or CEOs of very powerful companies most often show clear signs of psychopathy. That is a lack of empathetic understanding of others around them. Why? Because by being psychopathic, one does not care to step over the bodies, so to speak, of other people or to do some backstabbing to become very, very powerful. That is why governments around the world are often run by psychopathic individuals. Sounds weird, but it's really the case.
Right.
Such people are very good in feigning empathy and feelings, okay, acting like they care. Yet inside, they only feel the need for what we would say self-enhancement. And this is why power always needs checks and balances, like in a healthy democratic society that tries to control unconstrained power. unfortunately, I need to say, real democratic checks and balances are very rare in this world. Especially the US cannot be an example of this anymore.
Right. And I do want to get to some of those checks and balance a little bit later, right? We dive into it a little bit later. But, you know, the reason I asked, about, you know, whether you need empathy in, let's say, a relatively normal scenario, or like a relatively normal political situation, you need to have empathy and all of that to gain power in the first place. The reason I asked this is because I'm wondering when that transition happens. Because we have seen in the past where, you know, a leader from the grassroots, you know, they are very kind, they are benevolent, or at least seemingly that way, right? They are someone who seemingly wants to do good, and as they rise up the ranks, perhaps let's say even once they become prime minister or president or someone very high rankings, you know, initially they might be okay, but then after that, you know, a lot of the top leaders in all over the world, you know, they get involved in cronyism, corruption, so on and so forth, right? For example, let's just take Malaysia, for example, right? There was this reformist government, Pakatan Harapan, which fell after 22 months in power, after some so-called reformist members of parliament decided to jump ship to the other side of the aisle, pretty much abandoning the coalition and the cause that they were part of, and allegedly it's because of political power play, ministerial positions, power and money, so on and so forth. Now, the thing about some of these people who jumped ship are some of the very same people who at one point took it to the streets, they demanded for reforms, they have been arrested by the same crony government that they, the same power or the old power that they were, initially, pushing against. So what do you think happens in these situations?
Right. So there are actually three questions in your multiple questions that are very important and that I would like to answer. So I will try and answer them separately.
Okay.
So first of all, you can ask yourself the question, why does this happen? And does it happen, for example, specifically in the realm of politics? Huh? Because we're talking about politics now.
Right.
Well, you could say in general, this kind of power corruption happens to everyone. Mm-hmm. We need to have some boundaries in our lives, or we go out of control. That is with everything. Think about, for example, a porn addiction. Once we have unconstrained access to sexual stimulation, many human beings cannot control and become addicted. Again, this is because boundaries keep us in control. Again, think back about the Holy Scriptures I just talked about and how important constraint, self-constraint also is in these scriptures. Power works the same way. A total unconstrained access to anything, such as women, cars, parties, results in psychological corruption and an addiction to getting more and more and more. Look at people like Jeff Bezos, who has so much wealth, hundreds of billions of dollars, this is so much that he can literally pull multiple African countries out of poverty with his personal wealth. He is so obscenely and immorally rich that even if he would spend millions every day, he would still be obscenely rich after 200 to 300 years, but still he refuses to give his workers a decent living wage. He goes to outer space while there is climate change, destroying the world, and still he wants more and more profit. So the brain, once it gets everything, cannot stop wanting more. Now, you asked then, how does this transition happen? Okay, when do you go from someone who is kind of benevolent, someone who wants to do good, how do you suddenly go into corruption?
Right.
Well, like I said, this happens when someone suddenly gets unfettered power. This can have, you could say, an intoxicating effect. If you suddenly have tremendous wealth and power, you may see that psychopathic tendencies suddenly happen. You see it when people have uncontrolled power over others, for example. Think about prison guards or police officers holding others in custody, what you will often see is that with sudden uncontrolled power, they will start abusing their prisoners. This was, for example, shown in the Stanford Prisoners Program, which was a psychological study on what happens when people suddenly have total power over others. Very normal people, often formerly very good people. Almost always with that uncontrolled power over others, physical and sexual abuse happens. This is what we see, for example, with US occupying Iraq, Syria, or Afghanistan, where physical and sexual abuse of locals by US soldiers is a significant problem. Think about, for example, the Abu Ghraib situation or Guantanamo Bay. Similarly, one of the biggest taboos about, for example, European colonialism is how European power, absolute power in the colonies, resulted in mass physical slash labor and sexual abuse of local people. Now, you were talking about the Malaysian example in particular, for example.
Right.
And how the government fell, and then some politician jumped ship to the other side, even though the politicians were, you say, fighting for justice and so on before.
Yeah.
Now, I am not too aware of Malaysia, but I can tell you about what I see, for example, in the United States. I say the United States because most people are relatively aware of the U.S. in the world. Most of your listeners have probably heard of what they call the Squad in the United States, which consists of a group of young socialist politicians, such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Ilhan Omar. These were such a big promise, these politicians, to us all when they ran for Congress. Millions of people in the U.S. and around the world supported them to become the new socialist face of U.S. politics. Now, years later, they have become not only part of the Democratic establishment in Washington, they actively push back against activists and socialists who ask, why is nothing happening? So the Squad now has an extremely well-paid job. Okay, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, and so on. So they have, you could say, they have become famous idols with millions of followers, and they get fancy Netflix contracts and fancy book deals. This has changed them. They don't want to fight the same corruption as before in their own political environment because they do not want to lose this beautiful, wealthy, and powerful life. Again, here you go with the nature of corruption in the human mind. Once we have so much wealth and power, we cling onto it and we want even more.
So just a quick follow-up on that, right? Then is that why people say when it comes to, you know, politics, when it comes to looking up to these figures, right? Figures with a lot of power, where even if you know, when it comes to people like Jeff Bezos and whatnot who are not in politics, I mean, this is why people say it's, you know, if it's within the realm of politics, you know, have two options, three options, it's a matter of just choosing the lesser of the evils.
Can you clarify that a little bit more? What do you
mean? Because I'm wondering if you are saying, like, you know, even people like AOC and all of these people who, once they get a taste of power, they eventually sacrifice some of their ideals. Then is that just the reality of the situation in which most, if not all of these people, might not, you know, AOC is not going to become Trump, for example, but, you know, some of our ideals are sacrificed and things like that. And so when it comes to the voters or the people or the common man, we just have to pragmatically look at it as we are always going to be dealing with some form of evil. So we shouldn't idolize them or anything. Just vote which one is the best.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And that's what the problem right now in the United States is called, lesser of two evilism. Mm. Is that both parties are bad, so we go for the least worst party. Okay. Well, actually, what does this say? It says that whatever the choice, you choose evil. So that means your political system is broken.
Right.
The only good thing one can have is checks and balances in a political system, which we will talk about later, you just said.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? That if you only have lesser of two evilism in a system, it means the political system is broken, and it means that you, as activists, for example, cannot reach your goals through electoral means. It means that outside activism, mass mobilization, that kind of stuff would maybe change your society. But through electoralism, you see that in the United States, for example, it becomes more and increasingly clear that through the conventional political system, change is not going to happen. So you make a good point, yes.
On the show with me today is Assistant Professor Dr. Karim Bertash, lecturer in social psychology and global political economy at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. After the break, I'll be asking him about the checks and balances required to prevent, from crossing that line, particularly politicians, and why countries like Singapore seem to be able to do well despite not having these checks and balances. We'll be back with more on Today I Learned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Today I Learned. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Assistant Professor Dr. Karim Bertash, lecturer in social psychology and global political economy at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. And we are talking about power, how absolute power corrupts absolutely, and why this happens. So, Karim, does this notion of, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, apply on a larger scale? I think you just touched on it a little bit earlier, but perhaps you can dive into it slightly deeper. Like when we talk about, when I say larger scale, I mean not just within the US, for example, or within Malaysia or within China, but on a global scale when it involves, the superpower nation. So, for example, when one superpower nation, as they grow from strength to strength, then they start wanting to invade other countries, perhaps get resources from other countries, although perhaps what they already have for themselves is perhaps more than enough. Is that the same concept you're talking about, as a country, nation becomes stronger on a global scale? Even that is an issue, that they tend to fall into this problem of corruption and all things evil.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good question. And that's the interesting about humankind or mankind, is that everything you see on an individual level, we often also see on a group level.
Right.
Okay. We see individual psychosis, we see group psychosis, we see individual narcissism, we see ethno-narcissism. So that's a very interesting thing that you also see that on the group level. And it's the same with power, definitely. So this brings me back to what I said before about US imperialism and European colonialism as very, very good examples. Now, in 2021, indigenous groups, both inside the West, think about Black people, think about former colonial people, descendants of colonial subjects, but also outside the West, okay, the new generation also outside the West, are finally pushing the discussion of Western power and colonialism to the foreground that goes beyond the mythological explanation, the indoctrination that colonialism was a modernization and a civilization of people. Okay, this was a big lie. It's one of the biggest lies in history. Colonized countries were richer and happier before colonization. When we talk about Indonesia, when we talk about Philippines, for example, okay, these were rich, relatively happy nations before colonization. After colonialism, all former colonies became much, much poorer. And still today, all former colonies struggle with poverty and also cultural identity issues due to 100 years of cultural psychological humiliation. What the new generation does, for example, Black Lives Matter and many others, also here in Asia, for example, is finally starting to discuss the horrors of colonialism, in particular, the total abuse and exploitation of non-European people by Europeans. Why did this happen? Again, due to unconstrained power and dominance over others. So you would see in Malaysia, for example, that people were used to do cheap slave labor for the colonial occupier, okay? Slave-like labor, I should say. Highly, highly cheap labor and highly, highly exploitative. Another example is how Dutch colonizers in Indonesia would sexually abuse women and children who worked as servants in their houses. Okay, this happened on mass scale. Why? Again, because unconstrained power corrupts and makes people less aware and care less about other people's feelings. Only the gratification of one's own feeling, only the gratification of one's own group become important. So you could almost say that this is a kind of learned group sociopathy or psychopathy almost.
So I guess what I'm getting, I also want to know is, right, because like you brought up, you know, you talk about the European superpowers, the West, which of course, you know, includes America, and how, you know, they have conquered, colonized various parts of the world for many, many, many decades and so centuries, right? And so I guess, you know, and because of that, that's why when, you know, when we look at, you know, media outside of the American or the West mainstream media, when we talk to academics and all these things, such as yourself, even Peter Beattie and all that, most people seem to be in agreement that the rise of China is a good thing when we zoom out and look at it from a global perspective, because at least now there's a superpower from the East as well, you know, to sort of counter the West. But even when we look at this superpower from the East, right, they are not this great, you know, perfect, idealistic country that is here to challenge the West. They are doing, you know, a lot of terrible things, human rights violations within their country as well. And even from a global scale, as China has become more and more powerful, now they are doing the same thing that maybe not to the extent, of course not maybe not to the extent at all when we look at it historically as the West, but they in the current situation, they have started to, you know, invade other people's territory, other nations' territory without permission, you know, and all these kinds of things. So I guess my question is this just the reality of the world, in that, you know, what we can hope for is just balance, but not a sense of ideal sort of utopia, because there will always be this power. Power will always corrupt. So what you're hoping for is, you know, both sides are, you know, equally strong, some sort of balance.
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say that China is a very big difference than the United States. I would push back on that a little, in that China, for example, in the way they deal with other governments, let's say in Africa, is not by, for example, military and colonial domination, but the Chinese are actually helping out these local communities, building infrastructure and all of that stuff. So it's a very different kind of way of dealing with their more increasing economic power than the United States. The United States, which has only pretty much learned the European colonial style of absolute domination over other people. So you know what it is. The United States has for many decades been so all-powerful that it lost the ability to consider other people. Okay, right. You could say this is a collective form of corruption. The U.S. does not have the ability anymore to consider other nations' humanity. We really can notice this. Okay, we can really notice this, that the U.S. does not know how to consider other groups anymore. It has become an unhinged, all-powerful global tyrant. This brings me back to the checks and balances. Indeed. During the Cold War, the world was bipolar, and there were, in a sense, checks and balances, because Russia was a counterpole to the U.S. power. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, this disappeared, and this has turned the United States into an unhinged, crazy global tyrant that is waging war everywhere, that is squeezing out populations everywhere. And according to Norwegian professor, if I remember correctly, Johan Galtung, if I remember his name correctly, said that in the past, after the Second World War, so after 1945, the United States has probably killed more than 20 million people in 37 countries around the world, completely out of control. Now, in my opinion, indeed, luckily China is coming, because the United States is out of control and pushback is needed. Don't forget, China has suffered also under colonialism. China know what the humiliation of colonialism is. China has a very different cultural history, very, very different than the history of individualism, domination, expansion that is very much part of European culture. It is not a surprise that capitalism evolved out of European culture. Okay? Capitalism, the continuously struggle for profit and expansion, is a cultural product out of Europe. So once you have another culture that starts to become all powerful, you will see that their thousands of years of history will shape the world in a way that fits their culture more. So unfortunately, we are not going to experience anymore because it takes time. But if we go far into the future and China becomes a new world power, you will see that it shapes the world in a very different way, because China has a very different philosophical and cultural heritage than the expansionist capitalist culture of Europe. I don't say it's worse or better from China, but I'm going to predict that it's different, because capitalism is a system that really, really comes from European culture. So that brings me also to your question, like, okay, are we doomed to always need two countries, or at least a multipolar world? Otherwise, we are doomed. Well, yeah. In a unfettered system of global capitalism, yes, because capitalism is inherently expansionist and unfair, because capitalism can only exist by exploiting others. Because if you want profit that is centered in one group of people or one person, you need to exploit other groups of people, because otherwise you cannot make profit. This is just pure statistics. So we need a different system. How can we need a different system if we have another country with thousands of years of a different cultural tradition building a global system that is also different? What it will be, we don't know. But at least we know that if you want a different global system, you need a completely different thinking kind of culture. Okay, I say thinking kind of culture. And maybe, just maybe, China can be like that in the future. We just don't know.
Right. Now, let's bring it on a micro level a little bit more, bring it back, rein it back in. You brought up checks and balances. We talked about it a little bit. But I'm also wondering, is this why, you know, when we talk about power corruption and things like that, how people, you know, slowly get more and more corrupt as they rise up the ranks. Is this why, you know, for example, in countries like the US, I know US is not perhaps the best example in terms of politics, but they do have the system, like a two-term limit for a prime minister, for example, for a president, for example, independent and other systems, like, you know, independence of the judiciary, freedom of the press. Not just US, many other countries have these things as well. Are these things, you know, necessary in preventing from a politician from crossing that line?
The most important thing indeed is a system that has checks and balances. Like I said before, multiple independent bodies need to be able to observe and check the power of other bodies. Think about the legislative branch of government being independent of the judicial branch or the executive branch, so that they can keep each other in check. Let's say police officers abuse their power and abuse prisoners. When you have a judicial system that is independent of the executive branch, a judge can punish criminal police officers because they are independent of each other. The problem is when this independence disappears. A judge will not punish police officers if that police officer is so powerful and has so many connections also in the judicial branch that the judge is scared of repercussions. You see, that is the importance of total independence of different governmental brands. It's the same with politicians. When politicians are misbehaving and an independent police force and judicial force can imprison them, then you have a good situation. However, when there is no independence and the politician is so powerful that people in the judicial branch, for example, fear for their job or even their life when they act against them, then corruption sets in, because the politician gets unconstrained power. So what I don't mean is that politicians, for example, who have fallen from grace are being imprisoned. That happens all the time. This is what always happens and does not prove the independence of a different governmental branch. What would really prove the independence of different branches in government is when highly powerful, highly popular often politicians still can be tried in court when they misbehave. So I'm talking about the George Bush, who started an illegal war that killed millions of people. I'm talking about the Tony Blair. But I'm talking also about right now, for example, the case against Epstein in the United States, who had a private island with where there were sexual acts with minors, and where Bill Clinton was coming. And currently there is a case against who is that? Prince Andrew in Great Britain. Let's see if he will be tried in court, okay, the Prince Andrew, because I'm going to bet it won't happen. So there you see there's no independence, right?
Right.
This is very, very important. So exactly, you got that very, very correct. You need an independence of judiciary, and also very important, I don't know if you just said it, but freedom of the press.
Yeah.
That the press can really check what power is doing. You saw that with Julian Assange. Julian Assange showed the world the real imperial face of the United States by showing videos of U.S. soldiers having fun, enjoying killing innocent civilians. That was so powerful. That is so damaging to those in power that now they are chasing him and imprisoning him, and hopefully. I guess they are hoping that he will never ever get out, because you see that he is in a terrible situation in prison. So there you see that once you have a freedom of the press, power becomes scared because it can keep them in check.
Now, I'm wondering, Karim, from an individual level, because like you said, you know, the individual also translates to the group. You know, there's a reflection, there are parallels there. So I'm wondering, from a psychological perspective, right? What is, you know, in a government, you talk about checks and balance, we talk about freedom of the press, independence of judiciary, so on and so forth. We are watching the government. So from an individual level, right, I'm wondering what actually these checks and balances do to you psychologically. Because, for example, right, you see this all the time. Some of us probably have done it. Let's say we're not supposed to litter, right? But if we know that we are walking down the street and absolutely no one is watching us, we are more inclined to just, you know, throw the piece of paper on the floor or whatever and just on the road and just move. But if we know that there's someone there walking behind us, we will be like, okay, never mind, I'll wait for the dustbin and then throw it there. So this is a kind of, is this the sort of checks and balance? I'm wondering, what is it that about people watching you that makes people feel like, okay, I should probably toe the line a little bit?
Yeah. So how much does it actually play that into our consciousness?
Yeah.
That people are observing us, so to speak. Well, for people with a good dosage of empathy, like I said before, it matters a lot. Most of us will know the guilty feeling we get, for example. And we all know the guilty feeling we get when we do something our mother would not have liked us to do, okay? Even when she is not there. This means you have a healthy dosage of empathy, because you feel guilt even if people don't know what you're doing, okay? There's a good dosage of empathy. In fact, psychological studies have shown that when you hang up posters on a wall with simply human eyes that are staring at you, near places where people stole their bicycles, for example, the amount of thefts will go down drastically. So even the perception of some eyes pushes most people, or at least a lot of people, to start behaving more properly. Okay. So this relates to us having evolved as group species, remember? But again, people with more psychopathic tendencies, people with a lower amount of empathy, of course, they care less. Many times, parents, for example, of psychopaths, such as serial killers, often will tell you that the signs were there already early on, okay? Because these kids were often, they lack caring for the effects of their negative behavior, or they would show cruelty against animals at a very young age. Okay, so it really depends how powerful your empathetic system really is.
But at the same time, right, Karim, when we look at it on the flip side, people always point to countries like Singapore, for example, and say things like, you know, Singapore is pretty much a dictatorship. You know, I mean, it's democracy in name, but it's not really. And when there's, you know, because there has only been one party dominating for years, you know, a large part of their history has been run by father and then son for years and years and years and years. And, you know, there are no checks and balances in Singapore. There's no such thing as two-term prime minister limit or any of those things, right? But this country is prosperous and the people are happy. And in fact, Lee Kuan Yew, the first prime minister of Singapore, his entire argument was that checks and balances is only there to slow down the government's plan. It's only there to disrupt the government's plan. So what is your take on this?
Right. This is a very difficult discussion, because in the West, we always think that we are free and countries like Singapore, they are unfree. But right. to this, I always say that is highly, highly subjective, because in the US you could also say it's a kind of dictatorship, because people like Julian Assange or Edward Snowden are also not safe for speaking up against their government, let alone a lot of the people who are black or brown in the United States are imprisoned, okay, compared to the more free people that are classified as white. So why am I saying this? I am saying this because freedom is always relative, okay? As long as people are happy, they will not revolt. Indeed, when you have an authoritarian government like in Singapore, and the people have a very decent standard of living, they have no reason to revolt. Why would you revolt if your life is good? Okay. So a very powerful dynasty like that of Lee Kuan Yew and his son can stay in power for a very long time, as long as they find a way to control the corruption of themselves because of their unconstrained power. Right. This issue, however, is very, very rare. Why am I saying this? Even though it went well with Lee Kuan Yew or even the son, you just need one descendant, like a son or a daughter, who takes over in the future and who cannot deal with all that power, and the whole society will collapse because there are no checks and balances. You see, that is why even in Singapore, the system is very, very flimsy, because it just needs one irresponsible person and life for its inhabitants can become very, very dark.
Right. On that note, before we wrap up this conversation, do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to leave us with regard to, you know, absolute power corrupting absolutely?
It may seem very attractive, to have all that power and money. All that, and we dream about that. But as history shows us, human beings are never satisfied and want more and more and more power, more and more and more money. Life is much happier when you cannot have it all, but you still have dreams of things you would like to have, things that seem unreachable, so that it remains a beautiful fantasy. For the super rich, all this fantasy is gone. They buy yachts, they buy tropical islands, they have all the sex partners they want. They literally own life. For them, the only fantasy that is left is more power, which is a bleak and very, very sad existence. So we all should be happy with our, well, relatively humble lives that allow us to sometimes daydream about the things we would like to do or the stuff that we would like to have. That's my word on it.
On that very, very wonderful note, honestly, thank you so much for speaking with me today, Karim.
My pleasure, Dashran. Anytime.
I've been speaking with Assistant Professor Dr. Karim Bertash, Lecturer in Social Psychology and Global Political Economy at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. And we were talking about power. Does absolute power corrupt absolutely? And why does it happen? If you missed any part of this conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Today I Learned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.